Okay, so I just I have to surmise what happened last week, and I decided the goal of this presentation is to calculate the density of state, the global density of state of the following Hamiltonian. It's a Hamiltonian which is defined in the continuum limit. It is an operator valued matrix which is 4x4, and in the upper right block here, we have something that has this structure here. Here I am using two Pauli matrix, and partial mu runs over 1 and 2, corresponding to spatial dimension horizontal for 1 and vertical for 2. So I'm dealing with a two-dimensional problem. And this is the kinetic energy of the clean system. And this implies that I'm dealing with a relativistic particle, because the energy, the dispersion of this particle essentially is controlled by the dispersion relationship is linear in momentum if you go to momentum space. And then I'm going to add randomness. And the randomness I'm going to add comes in four kinds. There are two types of disorder potential, A1 and A2, that couples to the same Pauli matrix as the Pauli matrix that appear in the kinetic energy. And then there are one other source of disorder, which I call A0, and it couples to the unit 2x2 matrix associated to the same sector as the Pauli matrix here. And the last type of disorder couples to the third Pauli matrix, the one that I had not used yet in the dispersion. And I assume that those different type of disorder are white noise distributed. It means that they are uncorrelated if you look at their variance at different position x and y in the two-dimensional plane. They are also and they are Gaussian distributed. That's another assumption I make. So it means that the only non-vanishing moment is the second moment, and it is given by a number g of a whenever mu and nu run for 1 and 2, the two dimensions in the two labels for horizontal and vertical direction in the plane. And that's the variance g of a of this type of disorder. And there is also a variance which is common to this guy here and this guy here, which I call g of m, just a name. And there is no variance, cross variance for mu and nu, which belongs to 1 or 2 or 0 and 3. So the cross correlations are 0. So that's the definition of the model. It's a continuum model, and it has a special symmetry which is respected by the disorder, because you see that I can write so this.
It's the same between 1 and 1 and 1 and 2.
Yes.
And
yeah.
2 and 1.
Yeah. So you can see that it has this matrix has an off diagonal block structure. And
nothing between 2 and 1, right? I mean, A mu, A, there is a delta mu.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry.
This is just expressive rotation.
Yeah. I didn't understand your question, sorry. And what makes this problem special is that it has this off-diagonal block structure, which means that if I square this Hamiltonian, I get something which is positive definite. Hence, the eigenvalues of the square of these Hamiltonians are all positive. The eigenvalues of the square of these Hamiltonians are all positive. So all the eigenvalues, if I take the square root of the square root of the square of this Hamiltonian, I get back the eigenvalues of these guys, but they come in opposite signs. They are always paired by opposite signs. And so the disorder respects this symmetry for any given realization of the disorder, and that makes the band center of the problem very special. So if I had discretized the system, I would have a vertical axis which is energy, and all the energy eigenvalues come in pairs, and hence the band center is very special, because as you make the system size bigger, automatically the level spacing reduces itself, and the lowest positive energy eigenvalue as measured with respect to the band center will see its mirror image here, which will be very close, and then you will have a lot of level repulsion physics that should kick in. Okay, so the band center is going to be special naively if the problem, if you're dealing with a localized, if the system if the wave functions close to the band center and at the band center were all localized, then you would expect the density of state because of this enhanced level repulsion at the band center to vanish as you approach the band center. But what happens really in this system is that the density of state obeys has different type of behavior, but in particular, in the case that I'm interested in, it's going to diverge. So the case I'm interested in is arbitrary GM and arbitrary GA. And what you find is that for arbitrary GM, what you find is that the density of state is diverging like 1 over energy times a correction. And this correction has this exponential form. Inside the exponential, you have a log. And the log is raised to some power. And this is an exponent that is actually universal. And it turns out to be 2/3. And the goal of this talk is to explain why we have 2/3. The number C here is non-universal. I cannot compute it reliably using field theory. But it depends on the macroscopics. But this exponent is supposed to be something that I can capture by some calculation in the continuum limit. And the reason why I have this exponent 2/3 can be understood, can be traced back to another interesting phenomena when I switch off GM. So GM I set equal to 0 here. And I'm then dealing, I can erase this part and this part of the Hamiltonian. I only deal with a random vector potential in this case. And for this case, which is a bit simpler than the one when GM is larger than 0, I can show that the density of state is a power law with an exponent Z of A that is fixed once you have chosen the variance G of A of the disorder. So you can say that any G of A is going to define something critical, a critical theory, because as defined by the property that the density of state obey a power law with some scaling exponent that depends on G of A. And the dependence of this power here, this exponent here, is given here and here. And the difference between the line up, the upper line, is that here, G of A is smaller than 2 pi, whereas here, G of A is larger than 2 pi. And of course, we are assuming G of M is equal to 0. And you see that the scaling exponent that you have here is a function of G of A, and this function of G of A is non-analytic function of G of A at the value of G of A is equal to 2 pi. And now my claim is that this property of the subsystem obtained by switching off this and this type of disorder is responsible when you put back GM not equal to 0 for this exponent 2/3. And the goal of this presentation is to give you a feeling for why the scaling exponents here, which are functions of G of A, are non-analytic at 2 pi, and hence follows that when I put G of M, I get an exponent 2/3. And I should mention that prior to this discovery that the correct exponent was 2/3, people believe it was 1/2. And the mistake then was I will tell you what went wrong in the prior calculations that predicted that you should have a 1/2 instead of a 2/3. And it is essentially that they missed the fact that the scaling exponents here in the baby theory obtained by switching off GM has a scaling exponent that is an analytic function of G of A. So we want to see if we can explain that, understand that, at least give a plausible argument for this phenomena.
Just one technical point, you have imaginary scalar and vector potential.
Yes. Yeah. But of course, the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. Okay. So last week, I'm going to jump that. So let me do I would like to try to give you my intuitions for how we can understand that. And the intuition I realize going back and forth from describing a system in a finite box, L, and a system in a termodynamic limit, but a system in a termodynamic limit for which you have to compute the Green function, H, Hatsugai, Wen, Komoto. So this H of Hatsugai, Wen, Komoto, those letters stands for the people who introduced this problem with this type of disorder and calculated the RG flow of the coupling constant G of A and G of M to one loop for the first time. So I call this Hamiltonian H of Hatsugai, Wen, Komoto. So when you want to compute the density of state at some energy epsilon, you have to look at the Green function at this energy epsilon. And it turns out that if you set up a field theory to calculate this resolvent at finite energy, you realize that the energy can be thought as a symmetry breaking term. Actually, the symmetry breaking term, you can even without referring to field theory, you can understand why it is to be interpreted as a symmetry breaking term. Why? Because I told you that this Hamiltonian has a special property which is true for any given realizational disorder. Namely, there exists an operator which is unitary and anti-commutes with this Hamiltonian here. So let me call this operator gamma. So there exists a gamma such that H Hatsugai when Komoto gamma is equal to minus this. And of course, the Green function at, so this is the Green function at the energy epsilon, and you see that the Green function at energy epsilon, if I act on the left and right with this operator, then I get G of minus epsilon. So you see that at finite energy, at finite energy, you are connecting, you are relating with this unitary transformation, the Green function at positive energy with the Green function at minus energy, and this doesn't imply symmetry. Of course, at zero energy, I think I made a mistake here. I have to put a minus here, and then in that case, you have something special happening at zero energy. And this has a counterpart in field theory. It tells you that epsilon acts like a symmetry breaking term. So if it acts like a symmetry breaking term, in some sense, it's going to introduce a length scale in the problem. So if I work at finite energy as I should be to calculate the density of state at finite epsilon, then what is going to happen is I'm going to introduce a length scale in the problem, a length scale xi, or if you want, a box size of linear size L. Okay? So now the idea is that the way you want to do a calculation of that type is that you put a perturbation. If you want, epsilon acts like a perturbation that breaks a symmetry that opens a gap. And as epsilon is going to run away to strong coupling, the length scale xi is going to be becoming shorter and shorter. So you'll get, effectively, you'll move with RG to smaller and smaller box size. As you move to smaller and smaller box size, the level spacing is going to become larger. Okay? And since we are interested in what happens very close to the band center, I can imagine putting myself here at some energy. And as I change either the system size, or if you want, I let epsilon run, what I'm going to see, as in a movie, I will see energy eigenvalues that are going to pass by. Okay? And to compute the density of states, what I really need to know is at what rate those energy eigenvalues are passing me at the position what I put on this vertical axis. So if I know at the rate at which those eigenvalues are passing by, I can obtain the density of state. Now imagine that you do this thought calculation for different realization of the disorder. What happens is that the level spacing is different for different realization of the disorder, and the rate at which the eigenvalues are moving in quote unquote when you increase the system size is also going to be different because the randomness changes those properties of the spectrum. Okay? So now the question is, if I want to understand what is the rate at which eigenvalues are moving as epsilon is running, or L, the box size, is being changed by hand, then I ask the question, what should I use as a criterion? Should I use average speed at which eigenvalues are passing if I were to repeat this operation for different realization of disorder? Should I use the typical speed? Are they different? Okay? And so I need a criterion to decide if the distribution at which eigenvalues are moving when I change the system size, if this distribution is broad or very narrow. If it is a narrow distribution, I don't worry about the distinction between the mean speed at which eigenvalues are moving or the typical value at which eigenvalues is moving. But if the distribution becomes broad, for some reason in a large box system size, then I better be careful about this distinction. Okay? And then the point is that if you look at the typical speed at which eigenvalues are moving as you change the system size, as you let epsilon run under RG, then if you look at the typical value of this speed, you'll get the exponent 2/3. Whereas if you were to look at the average value of this speed, you will get the exponent 1/2. And then my claim based on intuition is that you should look at the typical value. Why the typical value? Because the density of state is a global density of state that I want to compute, and it is a self-averaging quantity. So if I look at one big system, and I was to, I fix the system size, but it's large, and I look at one realization of disorder, in principle, I could compute the density of state for this realization disorder, but I should get a very good approximation to what happens in the Chomedic limit. So that's the notion of self-averaging, and hence, if it's enough to look at a typical realization of disorder to get the density of state, then I should care about the typical rate at which eigenvalues are moving as I change the system size. Okay, so now I want a criterion. I want to check if I am allowed. I must distinguish average versus typical values of the rate at which eigenvalues are moving as I change the box size or if I let epsilon running. And to do this, I have to essentially introduce a notion of a dynamical exponent z of a. The dynamical exponent z of a is precisely connecting the running of epsilon with the introduction of a length scale psi, which is changing as epsilon is running. And yes?
So when you first started talking about eigenvalues moving as a function of box size, I thought this was just a heuristic device to explain things, but you seem to be putting quite a lot of stress on it, so I wondered how seriously we should take it. And in particular, if you want the eigenvalues to move continuously as you change box size, then
I think you asked me this question about 10 years ago, kind of related question 10 years ago, and I gave it. It's only intuition. It's just I'm trying to give you a motivation based on my intuition, I guess. I don't know how, yeah, of course, changing how you fix a realization of disorder and then you change the box size, it's not obvious how you will do that you will really do that. But
if you look at the actual calculation, it doesn't rely on any such images or something, right?
Well, once you know the answer, I guess. But at least it was useful for me to think in those terms to you know, you have to, I need the guide. I mean, you can do many things in calculations, but I needed the red line, a guiding principle. Actually, I don't think, in the context, so I don't want to say anything more than that. So it's an intuition that I am trying to, it's my personal bias that I'm trying to impose on you. Okay, so now I'm going to quote results. I'm not going to explain them, but I'm going to quote them. But the reason why I'm quoting them is because I want to tell you that in this problem, indeed, there are very good reasons for us to think that typical and mean are very different. And so the first result I'm going to quote is that you can extract out of this Hamiltonian a zero mode. So it means that I'm going to forget the case of G of M larger than zero. I focus in the first part of the talk on G of M equal to zero. This case is a bit simpler. And now when G of M is equal to zero, so this term, those two terms are gone, you focus on this part here. And it turns out that you can extract a zero mode for this Hamiltonian. So it is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian with vanishing eigenvalue. And it looks, at the end of the day, if you forget about the spinner structure of this zero mode, because it's a wave function that has four components. But if you extract the spinner structure, you kill it out, you essentially end up with an object of that form. And this object depends on the disorder potential. So this is a wave function that you can obtain for any given realization of the disorder potential. Okay, and what is phi 2? So what I do is that I represent my random potential here as epsilon mu nu partial mu phi 1 plus partial mu phi 2. Okay. Now you can show that if you represent your randomness, the random vector potential that is sitting here, if you represent it in terms of two scalar field in this fashion, then you can show that essentially the zero mode can be of this Hamiltonian has this form. And here I have taken the zero mode and put it in a box of size of area L square. I have normalized it.
Haven't you switched one and two? Isn't it the other way around?
No, not in this problem. So so it's the pure gauge part that that enters the
imaginary.
Yeah. It's reversed. So and then what you can do is that you can perform what people call in localization theory, in Anderson localization theory, multifractal analysis of this object. And so the multifractal analysis can extract for you information about whether the system is localized or not. And so you define an object that depends on a number q. It's a real number. And p of q is defined by integrating over space, two-dimensional space over the box L square. And then you take the squared value to the power q of this wave function here. Now, assume that the wave function is a plane wave. If it is a plane wave, then the amplitude square of the wave function is going to be 1 over L square, I think. So if you raise it to the power q, you get a factor of q here. And then you multiply. It's a plane wave, so when you square it, you don't have a dependence on x. So then you get only a factor of L square coming from integration over space. So this is going to scale like 1 over L to 2q minus 1. 2q minus 1, I think, something like that. So, and in particular, this quantity, if this wave function was a plane wave, this quantity in a thermodynamic limit would vanish. Now, if you had an exponentially localized wave function, which I can caricature as a box of size, the support of this non-vanishing wave function is psi, then you have to replace L by psi in this quantity, and you see that this number, this P of Q in the thermodynamic limit, L going to infinity, is some number between 0 and 1. So this is a criterion that tells you a wave function is either box local, you know, is like a box, like an exponentially localized wave function, if this quantity in the thermodynamic limit is finite. But if this quantity in the thermodynamic limit goes to zero, it's like a plane wave, or it's kind of extended. It knows about the boundaries of the system. And of course, what could happen is that if it is extended in the sense that, or if there is some notion of scaling in the sense that this quantity scales with the system size, you could imagine that the exponent here that I define to be tau of, function tau of q, you could imagine that this function of tau of q is not simply a straight line, but is more complicated. And now you can actually calculate this function tau of q for psi of x, or more precisely, you can calculate a version of tau of q for this wave function. And I tell you what is the version I have in mind. So
range for q?
Q is real.
Real,
because my wave function is always positive. So I don't have zeros, and I don't have to worry about negative q's.
It doesn't matter whether it's bigger or smaller than 1.
Q? Oh, you'll be very interested. So the physics of Q is like a microscope. If Q is very large, because I normalize the wave function, I'm going to project everything except for the maximum of psi. So psi raised to the power Q is going to tell you how many, what is the support of those points for which the function is very large. Conversely, if Q is very negative, you do the opposite. You look at what are the points that contribute to this integral such that psi of x at this point is very small. Okay, so it kind of selects a set of points for which the wave function has some given value. That's what Q is doing for you. It's a microscope. Of course, I want to draw an analogy to classical statistical mechanics. So let me just define the quantity z of 2q as this integral here, e to the minus 2q phi of x in the box of size L square. And now I can think of it a bit differently. I can think of Q, or 2Q, as being, if Q is positive, as being an inverse temperature. What I didn't tell you is that phi 2 is correlated like that. Phi 2 of x, phi 2 of y, average, when you plug, when you insert this this parametrization of this order, you insert into this rule, in this law, here you get something which goes like log x minus y, 1 over 2 pi, I think g of a here, minus. So what you have in this problem is a random function x that has this correlation in space, and this you can think as a random Boltzmann weight, and this you can think as a random partition function, okay? Where Q, 2Q plays the role of inverse temperature. And now you see that the quantity that we care of, we care for here, is some kind of ratio between this partition function evaluated at 2Q and the partition function evaluated at Q equal to 1. So this is my P of Q here is nothing but the ratio of two partition functions evaluated at different temperatures. Okay? And now you tell me that I want to extract something that scales with the system size. And now I have a choice in which I'm I have a choice in which way I'm going to try to extract scaling out of this P of Q. One possibility will be that I take the log of P of Q first, and then I disorder average. Or the other possibility will be that I take the disorder average of P of Q, and then I take the log. And it's not obvious that you can commute averaging and taking the log. In other words, the question I am asking, roughly speaking, is that if I do this this operation here, what I'm looking at is log of z of, and I think here I had the power of q that is missing, and I have log of 2q minus q log of z2. That's what I will get if I do follow this procedure. Okay? And that, in my analogy to classical statistical mechanics, it's like a free energy at this temperature, and that's the free energy at a different temperature. Okay. I could also do a third. So this one, of course, I have to average the ratio of two random numbers. This is difficult. And then I could do one more approximation. I could do something different too, is that I could assume that averaging over space, so I could assume that averaging over space is the same as disorder averaging. I could make this assumption. So there is a notion of self-averaging kicking in. And if I do that, then I could say that P of Q is equal to average of Z of 2Q divided by Z of 2 average to the power Q. And then I could take the log of this quantity, and then I will get something that goes like log of Z of 2Q minus Q of log of the average. And actually, this is the easiest. This is something I can, if I make this assumption, I can compute, and that was computed in 94 by Andreas Ludwig and his co-workers. And what they found was that if you divide, now you want to extract a scaling exponent, so you have to divide by the log of the system size. But if you do that, and so I am after such a scaling exponent, and what they found was, I will call it not self-averaging tau of Q is equal to 2, 1, Q square times Q minus 1, where QC is equal to 2 pi divided by G of A square root. So that's what they found in 1994. Okay. So
why do you call it not self-evident?
Well, because there would be a problem. Well, you'll see. Well, I can tell you why.
I mean, doesn't it come from your assumption that things are self-evident?
Yeah. Well, but I'm saying it's not correct. So what should be the shape of tau of q if you were to compute tau of q? If tau of q exists for any given realizational disorder, then you can give some rigorous. Well, there are some properties of tau of q that are clear if I define tau of q before doing the disorder average. So if I just try to look at the scaling of this function p of q for a given realizational disorder, the exponent tau of q has to be a monotonic function of q. That's because psi of x is a number between 0 and 1, and if q is increasing, this number is decreasing, so its contribution to the integral is smaller. So tau of q has to be strictly...
Why is psi less than 1?
Because I normalized psi. It's a probability. It's the normalized wave function. It's a number between 0 and 1. Mm. I divided by this quantity.
But it's a continuous system. It's not on a lattice.
No, put it on a lattice.
Oh, okay, all right.
Okay.
Or if you average over some boxes of size.
Yes. Yes.
You
can do that. You can do that. Okay. So psi is normalized, and if psi is normalized, it has to be this function tau of q has to be strictly increasing. Okay. So whereas this function here is a parabola. So something happened. So now, what can you do? What you can do is that you can try to compute. I'll tell you right away. I don't know how to compute this quantity. I don't know. However, what we did was to compute this quantity here, the log of p of q, and then we do the disorder averaging. And when I say we compute it, actually, what we drew was an analogy to a problem of polymers that was solved by Spohn and Derrida in some years ago. So we drew an analogy, and you don't need to know why we believe that this will be useful to compute this log and then the disorder average. But let me give you the answer when you do that. So then, what happens when you compute? When you compute this quantity here, or when you compute, you extract the scaling, the function tau of q out of taking the log first and then this other averaging, what you find is that there is a regime which I call weak disorder, and for which qc is larger than 1, and the qc is defined here. And in this case, the tau self-averaging is equal to 2, 1 minus qc square times q minus 1 for q smaller than qc. So it is this result obtained in 94. But when q is larger than qc, then I get 2 times 1 minus the sine of q divided by qc times q. So it's linear.
Why do you call it now self-averaging?
Because you can prove that the quantity log of z of q is self-averaging. At least when I say you can prove it, they proved it for their problem. And we said the same holds for this problem. Okay? So you can show that the free energy is a self-averaging quantity. And the partition function is horribly fluctuating. Actually, you can compute the moments, how the moments of this quantity scale in the continuum. And you'll see that the moments of Z of Q blow up exactly in the same way as the moment of the random partition function on a polymer, on a directed polymer has a random partition. What they studied was a directed polymer on a Kelly tree. they define a partition function for this problem, and they showed that the moments of the random partition function blew up in a certain way, and those moments here blew up exactly in the same way. That's one analogy. There's another analogy that for us is that here this order was logarithmic correlated. I erased it, but phi here is a scalar field in two dimensions, so it has logarithmic correlation, so there is a notion of scale invariance. Of course, a Cayley tree is a construction that is by definition scale invariant. Actually, you can draw the analogy, you can define a neutral metric on this tree, which also depends on the logarithm of the, well, for which you can show that there is something like a logarithmic correlations for the randomness in the problem on the Cayley tree. So the fact that the conjecture that we used was the moments of Z of Q behave in the same way as the polymer problem. We also had the notion that there is scale invariance in the two problems, and that we could identify the two-point function of the disorder in the two problems. So then we said, let's borrow their results, translate via a dictionary, and then we'll get our result, and the result is here when QC is larger than 1.
But ultimately, it's a conjecture, right? You understand this, right?
Oh, it is. It is.
Some hypothesis.
It is a hypothesis, but it's right. numerically, it's pretty. But the rigorous proof, there are some steps missing in our. Well, we cannot reproduce the magic they did. But there are a lot. I think it can be done.
You don't get any sort of iteration equation for the partition function.
The evolution. Yes, you can.
Yes,
you can do the same thing.
But then on this basis, one should be able to sort of.
Well, that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to derive the KPP equation.
Oh, okay.
So.
But it's unusual to be able to treat a two-dimensional problem in the same way as a problem on the Cayley tree. Yeah?
Yes.
In some sense, a Cayley tree is a kind of mean field.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we were.
Very special random potential.
Yeah, it's a long, it's a long range correlation in the line.
Any two
dimensions. Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter how we derived it. We got this result. You can go and check it numerically. You can simulate this object numerically, and you can calculate tau of q, and you'll see that it does what it should do.
If you understand right, the Cayley tree problem is sort of a problem. There's sort of 1+1 dimensional where the time goes on. It's a directed polynomial.
Yes. Yes.
And you understand you're right that eventually the direction, the time coordinates have had the RG time. Is that what you want?
No. What? Okay. So on the Cayley tree, you have 1, 1, 1, phi, 1, 2, and then I think phi. I forgot the notations, but you have what you define is Gaussian random variables on every branch of the tree, and then you define at the end of the day some kind of some random variable which is a sum of all those random variables. And those are all uncorrelated, but the guy which is obtained by summing all the individual random variables along the path that you take along the tree is correlated with this one, because at one point they are going to share the same ancestors. So out of that, you can calculate, as I said, you can define the two-point function for two paths, and you can show that it depends on the log of something which is a ultrametric defined as, you can define an ultrametric, so a length, a real length on the tree, and then it's logarithmic. So that was one input. And then we just close our eyes. And I mean, there are, as I said, there are other reasons why we believe that we could make this step. But anyway.
The notion of length scale in the Cayley tree is just how far you go down.
Yes.
Tree, right? You rescale and go up or down.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then you can define the partition function as a function of system size, as the numbers of generations that you have, and you can show that it obeys a recursion relationship when you go from one level to the other level, and you can show something very similar here. So you can, okay, but. Okay, so that's when QC is larger than 1, and what you do, if I go back to a picture here, you'll see that the I'm starting from small disorder, so g of a is small, qc is very large, and I take this parabolic solution that Andreas found a long time ago, And then how is this solution here related to this one here? Well, so the relationship is the following, and it's very, very simple. You take the tangent to this parabola that crosses the origin here, and tangent of this parabola that crosses the so you take one tangent, the tangent that crosses the that touches the parabola intersecting the origin, and the other one that does the same thing for the negative part of the parabola, and then you keep the parabolic part until you hit the tangents, and then you continue with the tangents. And then when you do Lejeune transform of this tau of q, it's natural because tau of q is like a free energy. If you do Lejeune transform, you go back to an entropy like a quantity. So by this analogy, you can do a Lejeune transform and you define something which is called f of alpha. And alpha, and Akira gave a talk, and I think Millie gave a talk on the relationship between those quantities in here. But the beauty here is that you know that a parabola is mapped under Lejeune transformation into a parabola. So the not self-averaging tau of q will be mapped onto a parabola that has f of alpha that goes arbitrarily low, I mean, never stops. And then it turns out that this solution here tells you that you just keep that part of the parabola that is strictly positive, and you remove the part that goes negative. So it's very elegant. Of course, you could have said, well, maybe the order, well, I mean, that, as I said, people also compute this numerically, and this quantity doesn't need to be equal. So the exponent that you extract here, I will quote it. So here I have self-averaging exponent. Here I will have, I will quote that assuming, well, I don't know, you have to give a name, but let's say there is a tau star here, and maybe I'll call it tau star, double star. So this could be in principle different function of q. And it has its own merit. So you can try to see if it exists and it's well-defined. I don't know how to compute this quantity. And probably it doesn't have to satisfy the conditions that the function here actually. So maybe this one doesn't have to satisfy the condition that it is linear for, it is asymptotically linear for very large q, which this one satisfies, and you can show that it should, that the correct measure, multifactorial measure, should always satisfy this property. Maybe this one should not satisfy that. It means that you could have something going negative here, up to some minimum value of alpha. So, of f of alpha, you could imagine that you keep, for example, this part of the parabola until it reaches the maximum. So who knows? Maybe tau of star of q in this problem is obtained by taking the parabola until it reaches its maximum, and then it will mean that the Lejeune transform goes a bit negative. I don't know. I didn't compute this quantity. So
these are the things people like to compute, I guess, in
field theory. In field theory, it's easier to compute. Well, I don't know. Okay.
You can only calculate averages.
Yeah, but you have to be careful because here you are looking at something which is non-local. So there was a normalization to the wave function, and this object is non-local. So if you want to calculate it with the Gaussian field theory, you have to deal with a non-local object. If you don't want to deal with the non-locality of this object, you can exponentiate the normalization, and then you deal with the Liouville field theory. But you have to learn how to deal with Liouville field theory. And the way high-energy physicists deal with Liouville field theory is probably not adequate to our problem. So you never escape this difficulty of having to deal with a non-local object. Okay, here I have reached one conclusion that, and then there is what I call the strong disorder. And of course, this I mean QC smaller than 1. And then the formula of becomes minus 2, 1, minus Q, QC square, if Q is smaller than QC. And then you get 4 QC, Q minus absolute value of Q, if Q is larger than QC. And so when you look at this thing here, when Q is larger than QC, what happens is that this function tau of q is 0. So then what you have to deal with is this situation of strong disorder. So our parabola will be very narrow, and I think it will turn before q equals, so that's q, that's tau of q, Now I kind of forgot. But anyway, the point is that you take this part of the parabola, then it goes straight, but here you go flat. So that will be the correct tau of Q self-averaging. And I remember that I told you that the physical meaning of, from my point of view of Anderson localization, whenever tau of Q is finite, the wave function is extended. If tau of Q is zero for Q larger than one, then you will say by the usual criterion will tell you that the wave function is localized. And that's exactly what happens when this order is strong, namely when the critical value of QC is smaller than one, which tells you the normalization of the wave function is already is. You see, what happens is that you are guaranteed the object Z of Q becomes if you want, random variable when Q is large enough, low temperature, is guaranteed to be non-self-averaging. And what I define, the criterion I use to distinguish between weak disorder and strong disorder is when the normalization itself becomes non-self-averaging. Okay? And when normalization is non-self-averaging, then my tau of Q for Q larger than one is zero. And then conventional wisdom will tell you that you have localized wave function. This is very curious because you still have a diverging correlation length for upon approaching the band center, and you still have power laws, and the power laws, they are written here. So the counterpart to this transition here is precisely what happens here. So you can understand all of this behavior. All of what happens when Q is too large can be traced to non-elasticity of the dynamical exponent Z of A. Okay? So you can really go from scaling of the inverse participation ratio to the scaling of the density of states. And if you you can translate those formula here that distinguish those things with those two cases here.
Should I compare strong with weak disorder, or should I stay with weak disorder and compare different ranges?
You can put
bigger, smaller.
I forgot. I think the statement is that you can. Here I'm scaling with system size, and you have to turn scaling with frequency. Epsilon. Then you go for Z of A, and then you can plug Z of A, and then. So what I'm saying is that
my argument would be that GA is bigger. Goes through. Strong and weak GA, and that corresponds, I think, to your strong versus weak disorder. And was a mistake.
I think it isn't. Sometimes it's equivalent here because you see Q always comes with Q always multiplies G of A in this problem. So you can Q and G of A do the same thing for you. I can rescale things. My wave function is. I wrote it, I had a distribution. I could rewrite my wave function as G of A Q phi. I could rescale the disorders.
But then there would be no distinction between the strong and the weak.
No, yeah, because the point is that I have two knobs to make this I have two knobs to make the normalization non-self-averaging. Either increase Q, or I increase G of A. They come together. So I have. It's always Q times G of A that appears in those multifactorial in tau of Q. So I think that gives you only those two options there.
But still, we need to distinguish two regimes, strong and weak disorder.
No, I'm saying that this is strong disorder. That's the terminology that I use because of Anderson localization, but I'm saying that it's always those two cases. I just wrote down. This is just to say that tau of Q, this is already the same physics. Here it's the same physics, except that...
Q is large.
Yes.
In one case, it grows linear with Q, and the other, it's a constant.
You already explained that one issue that's important is whether the normalization for the wave function is self-averaging.
Yes.
And if I've understood right, Q doesn't enter that.
So there is no Q in this quantity.
Yeah, so as far as the normalization is concerned, you just care about
Yes. Andreas, are you asking me if there should be four cases? Here I have written four possibilities.
No, I'm asking whether the second line in this corresponds should be matched to the strong disorder.
It is QC equal to one. It is there. No, I will not say that, but I'm saying you can probe even here, you can probe the strong disorder regime, because when you put Q large, you are looking at strong disorder physics. It's the same thing, because it's always G of A times Q that appears. For multifractal, for the tau of Q, don't worry, I'm confusing, but...
I think we should discuss this.
No, but you just look, you can rescale... I can either make this, factor big by increasing Q for a given G of A, or the opposite. So I will always hit the strong disorder regime, which is tell you what are the distribution, which is essentially controlled by. If I increase this, if this number is large enough, the physics is controlled by rare events where the wave function is very large.
Yeah.
Okay, and I can do it in two ways. Okay. So now I have to attack the problem of the density of state and show how those things emerge from a field theory. So what I want is to actually, I will simplify a little bit the problem because the physics of G of M here, this G of M, the physics of G of this disorder and disorder is to give you scattering between, if you came from a lattice, there will be two Fermi points about which you linearize the spectrum, and there will be scattering event in the cones emerging from, within the cones emerging at this Fermi point and this Fermi point, or between the cones. A0 and A3, they connect the different non-equivalent cones, the non-equivalent Fermi points. A mu only connects what is only within one valley of your tight binding Hamiltonian node in a clean limit. So if I remove G of M, if I switch it off, I don't have to work with this 4x4 complicated matrix. I can simplify the problem a little bit. And so And now what I want to compute is something like H Hasugai when Komoto minus epsilon. I think I would do it like that. And I want to extract, so I need to compute, I can extract the density of state from the imaginary part of this object. And to this end, I use the following identities. I can integrate over the complex plane with two complex number. That's one option. And I can also do the same thing if I want if I use Grassmann variables. So psi are Grassmann variables, and those integrals are defined by those rules. And now I can combine, both in, if you want Riemann integration with Grassmann integration, to represent the resolvent as a path integral. So I do that, and now I switch to the screen. How do I put that on?
The green one.
Okay, so I cheat a little bit from the blackboard talk because it's just too painful to write everything. So with this trick of using Grassmann integration and Riemann integration, I can set up an effective partition function that will allow me to compute the single particle green function of the problem of interest. So I have integration variables, and in blue, those are the Grassmann variables. In green, red, I have the Riemann integration variables, the bosonic integration variables. Phi 1 and phi 2 is a disorder. So integration over phi 1 and phi 2 is because I have averaged my effective partition function. And I put primes here because what I have done is that I have done, I have decoupled the theory. I have done a trick that allows me to extract the critical part of the theory and something which is non-critical. And so I have done a rotation. I have changed integration variables, and my new integration variables are denoted have primes. Notice here that, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then I obtain a part of the theory which is critical, and it is characterized by all those correlation, two-point correlation functions that are, those are the non-vanishing one. What you want to notice is that, of course, this is a disorder. Phi 1 and phi 2 are the two scalar fields that I introduced to parameterize my random vector potential, and those are scalar fields in two dimensions, so they have the, they have this correlation function, and this is a scalar invariant correlation function. And of course, the fermions and the bosons, they are relativistic, and simply because they are relativistic, and here the minus and plus denote right movers and left right movers, and the A and B is a fact that I have four. So you see I have a structure where I have I have A and B that runs over, A and B run over two, take two values, and minus and plus take two values, and that gives me the four, component structure of my spinner here. So I have all those, if you want, flavor degrees of freedom. But what is important is that when I say the theory is critical, it means that those two-point functions, they are one of they are power laws. And Z is the position in the complex plane. Z bar, it's conjugate complex. Okay, so this is the part that comes from 1 over the Hamiltonian. Hatsugai when, well, Komoto with G of M equal to 0. And of course, I have to put a finite energy. And the energy appears here. If you ask me what this part here is, that I changed variables, so I had to account for a Jacobian when going from the MUs and the phi. It plays no role in our considerations. But here, you see that the disorder doesn't appear anymore in the critical part, but all the disorder is going to move to this part here, which is the part that tells you that you have a finite energy. And this part... This part looks like that. So, again, here in green, in red, I have bilinears. So it's simply, I have copy, I have a fermion psi labeled by one, another one by two, and their label is coming with right movers or left movers, I forgot the convention. So does the bosons, the same for the fermions. So when you see red, you think bosons, when you see blue, you think fermions, but the disorder is here. And notice that the disorder looks exactly like our wave function before. Okay? And here I wrote what are the bilinears in the FBs and company. So that's the energy. And the critical theory, the plus the this perturbation, this is supersymmetric by construction. And of course, when you want to, but what you want to compute is the density of states, so you have to compute some expectation value. And the expectation value that you have to compute, the operator you have to, for which you have to compute the expectation value that will give you the density of state is written here. And you see that it looks very similar to this one here, except that the sign minus minus here have become plus plus here, and plus plus here have become minus minus here. This was supersymmetric, this cannot be supersymmetric, and it should be like that because otherwise you will not, you will still get one when you average over the operator that is supersymmetric. So that's good. And now, what you want to do is that you want to set up, you want to understand what is the effect of this perturbation that breaks the symmetry of the previous Lagrangian that was critical. As I said, this is a relevant perturbation. It breaks a symmetry, so it's going to grow under RG. And I want to control, I have to have some control on the flow of this perturbation. Now, the problem is the following. In principle, people usually, they will have one perturbation. By power argument, they will say this is a marginal perturbation. That's the only one that is important by power counting. All higher powers of this, all terms that involve more fermionic fields, bosonic fields, will be irrelevant by power counting. So I don't have to worry about them. Unfortunately, the story is not like that in our problem. If you take the energy perturbation and you raise it to, you can construct the following object. This is the most general object that you can construct, which is a local object built out of our fermions and my bosons. And this object, you can compute the scaling dimension of this object exactly in this problem. And the scaling dimension of this object is written here. Here the m's are simply counting how many fermions I have, the n how many bosons I have in the product. This is the product of many fields at the same position in space. And here is their contribution to the scaling dimension. The fermions come with a square. The bosons, they come linearly. They add up. They don't add up as a quadrature. They add up linearly. And then you have a contribution coming from a disorder. It's here sitting. Here's the disorder. The effect of the disorder. And this is a very simple. The scaling dimension of this line here is easy to compute because this is a Gaussian field. And when you compute the scaling dimension of this object, it comes like g of a times this bracket squared. So this term is going to grow like m squared, and is going to be matched by this one here. Because here the sign is, you see, here you have a positive sign, but here you have a negative sign. So the positive sign of the m squared is going to cancel the negative signs of the m's here. But here, the bosons, they come only with, they only grow linearly here, whereas here they come, the n's come, grow quadratically. So this x, this scaling dimension is guaranteed to become negative if the n's, for the powers of the bosons, are large enough. So it means that you have infinitely many relevant operators, and those are exact scaling dimensions on the line of critical point. So the problem is that you cannot simply do RG, naive RG calculations dealing with only one relevant perturbation. You really have to do RG that includes infinitely many relevant operators. You cannot escape that. But still, treating all of them simultaneously is too hard. What we did was to select the most, we gave ourselves a criterion to select what would be the most nasty relevant operators. So what we do is that we fix the number n, which is simply I don't know how to go back. So this was the prefactor to the random potential that appears in the operator I wrote before, and I fix n. And then I ask, what are all the possible operators for which the scaling dimension with this constraint here is the same? So essentially what I am asking is I want to look at all the operators that share these scaling dimensions. And here I listed them. And they are built by taking n, little n bosons like that, capital N minus n bosons like that. And then I'm allowed to start adding fermions, but not too many fermions. If I add too many fermions, I get into problems. I'm going to, not problems, but I'm going to decrease the scaling dimension that I have here. So for a fixed n, when this quantity is fixed, those are the most relevant operators. So I want to keep only those guys. This is an assumption. This is a simplification. I look at the most. What I want to set up is I want to select a subclass of all relevant operators that are closed under RG. And I'm going to limit myself to do the analysis within the subclass of operators. I cannot do the whole family of operators. So let me. Here is, in principle, I have here all, here I have all those relevant operators for which I calculated. So I had defined operators that depends on m and n, and they have a coupling constant. And I knew that huge numbers of them become relevant for depending on the choice of m and n. And I'm going to truncate this huge family Z to a subset where the coupling constant I call y, in analogy to a fugacity in a random XY model. And the operator that I'm going to look is very simple. It follows from taking the energy perturbation and raising it to the power n. Okay, so I take the energy operator, raise it to the power n, I do a binomial expansion, and I only keep this term in the binomial expansion. And I define a plus minus in this fashion. And now I compute the OPEs of those operators, and Shinsei did this calculation, and you get the following rules. If you take a plus with n here, fuse it with a plus with n prime, and you get a plus now at n plus n prime. The scaling dimension is given of this new operator is given here. It is very, very negative. And then you get this combinatorial factor here. You could ask me, well, why didn't I choose a fugacity that had the opposite sign? So it means that instead of having a plus here, I will have an a minus. Had I chosen that, I would have not generated as relevant operators. I will have an annihilation process of that type where I get this thing here. But the point is that the exponent of this, the scaling dimension of this field given here, this thing here, this prefactor here, will be larger than zero, so it will be you could neglect it compared to the in the previous transparency. This object here was negative, so it blew up when z went to zero, whereas here it doesn't blow up. So I will neglect for this reason those are what I call charge annihilation, those kind of fugacities annihilation process. So now I can if I neglect all the annihilation processes, so I keep only the y of n, I don't have to put plus and minus anymore. What I know is that I can compute the beta functions of all those coupling constants, and I wrote it here. This is the beta function. I also know the scaling dimensions of those y of n, and I know the initial condition. I started with only one y of n when n is equal to 1. Okay, and then I know that my density of states has to obey a Kalman-Zimanski equation, which involves all those relevant operators. And actually here, when I write three dots, it means that it's not only one equation, but you have other correlation functions that appear. So it's an infinite set of correlation functions with all those coupling constants entering here and different scaling exponent here. Now, I can tell you, so now I do that. And I think I made a mistake. Now I should stop. I'm back on the blackboard. How do I move? So I wanted to save time by not having to write all those operators. But the moral of the story was that if I set up a field theory to compute the expectation value of the object that gives me the density of state, I saw that I automatically had to deal with infinitely many relevant operators. And this is not an approximation. Those are the scaling dimensions were calculated exactly. So you cannot blame me for, you cannot accuse me of some weird one loop calculation of the scaling dimensions that would be an artifact of my epsilon expansion of. And now what I can do is that I can introduce. The philosophy is that I want to do RG that take into account this infinite set of relevant operators. I want to treat them all on equal footing.
Sorry, I didn't understand how it was that they were exact scaling dimensions.
At the critical point. So I have
that was because it was just this random gauge potential model, which you could solve using supersymmetry, for example. So it's a Gaussian theory in the end. So you can calculate all dimensions of all operators just exactly their quadratic.
So that's at the point without the
energy.
GM.
Yes.
Yeah. And without GM. And without GM, but without the energy.
Yeah.
Okay. And now I define. So the idea now is to define. Little l is if A is the lattice spacing, I can go from A to e to the little l A. I change the lattice spacing, so that's my RG step. So L is a dimensionless number which is small, and then I can define this generating function, which is 1 plus pi over 2 sum n equal to 1 to infinity minus 1 to the power n e to the minus n y divided by n factorial times my running coupling constant. And now he just left, unfortunately, because if you, we know what is the RG flow obeyed by those guys to one loop, and now if you write the RG flow obeyed by this function here, we find that it obeys this equation. So that comes from the input was simply the one loop calculation of the beta function for all the yn. This is the input, then you make this definition, and then you just differentiate with respect to L, you move the differentiate, you move it to this guy here, plug the formula I gave you, I showed you, and then you get that that object here. And then there's an initial condition on the on this object, and this is equal to when I write this, okay, I'll tell you what it is. And this is, I work to linear order in epsilon. So I have 1 minus epsilon, but I exponentiated it for. So this is correct to linear, to the order in which I'm working.
What is the second letter in the last left-hand side under G12? What is that, C or A or what is it?
The initial condition. Okay. So this I can. So now this term is coming from the matter field, all my bosonic and fermionic variables. This, of course, is coming from my randomness because it comes with G of A. So now I can do a change of variable. I can define G of X of T, which is equal to my first object, G of A divided by pi, and then times X minus, so I do a Galilean boost, and this, so I know what function is, what differential equation is obeyed by this guy here. I make this change of variable, and then I get that G of X of T is equal to G tilde square root of G of A, sorry. So I get the differential equation, partial T of G is equal to 1/2 G plus G, G minus 1. And I won't write the initial condition. And this has a name. This equation was derived by Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Piskunov, and I think also somebody called Fischer, 1937 for the Russians. Okay, and of course, at this stage we're very happy because also this, by the way, this function was also derived in the context of the polymer problem. In the polymer, the directed polymer problem on the KA tree, what Spohn and Derrida showed is that they could write down a generating function for the random partition function that obey precisely this equation.
What role is played in that problem by the variable X?
So now I forgot. So I think it must be, okay, so you had, I'm not sure, I forgot, okay. And he's gone, but I think T probably is going down the tree, and X must have been this option here. But since he's not here, he cannot help me, or I cannot embarrass myself. So, but anyway, they derived this a similar equation in their problem.
Well, in their problem, is G something like the probability distribution?
It is the generating function for the cumulants of the, I think, of the partition, random partition function.
So X is a variable in the generating.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. I'm dumb. It's because it used to be Y here. Yeah, it's the artificial variable that we introduce.
It's an artificial variable.
Yeah. Sorry. So it's not space. Well, thanks. So now we're going to rely on the fact that a lot is known about this equation. And it turns out that initially, what we have is that if I actually plot in my condition 1 minus g, it looks like something like that. And if I, that's at L equal to 0, and x, that's as a function of x. And then it turns out that this equation has a solution, which is a traveling wave. No, I think it has a shock wave, but it has, what's the name of this thing? Oh, a traveling wave. So a traveling wave solution. So this thing that looks like a Heaviside function is still a Heaviside function at L very large. And actually, it is a function at L very large. It is a function. It looks like the following function. How does it work? It looks like this function. So that's the definition of a traveling wave, I guess. T. Sorry. So there is a velocity. You can write down the this equation asymptotically takes this form here. And V of A is known. And what is remarkable is that V of A is equal to square root of over 2 when G of A divided by 2 pi, by 2 pi is bigger than 1, and it's equal to 1 half square root of G of A divided by pi plus square root of pi divided by G of A if G of A divided by 2 pi is smaller than 1.
How does
G of A appear? Here it is. It used to be the diffusion coefficient here, but I moved it here. And it got the initial data. Initial data. So I have to give you the initial data. So it comes from the initial data. So initially, this function looks like 1 minus gx0 is equal when x goes to infinity to e minus square root of ga pi times x. This is so the initial data is going to tell you how you the initial this property here of my initial data selects v of a.
Yeah, so the graph is just reflected at the origin. I mean, it goes to zero as x becomes large.
Right? I took 1 minus g. Yeah. Okay, so I use those as input. And now I make the following. I rely on this intuition I was telling you about at early on in the talk about what I want to do is that I want to think of my energy epsilon that sits in the resolvent of my Green function. I want to look at it. I want to think of it as being some kind of moment. Well, I mean, it would be the first moment of some random variable. I would like to think about it like that. I was telling you that in this thought experiment, for every realization of this order, I have a lowest, in a finite system, I have the closest energy to the band center. And this should be a random variable. Okay? And epsilon, I think of it as generating a gap, so I think of it as generating this minimum energy as measured with respect to the band center. And I want to think of it in realization of this order, by realization of this order, as a random variable. And epsilon, the coupling constant that appears in my field theory, I want to think of it as the first moment of this random variable. And now, what I did was that I replaced epsilon by y1, and then I said that I had to introduce a lot of y capital N. So I want to think of those yn's as the cumulant of these random variables.
Y is the coupling constant.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, epsilon was the first coupling constant. I changed the name because, but the initial. So I want to think of all of those guys as as being the cumulus of some random quantity, which will be the location of the closest energy to the band center. So then, I want to think in a similar fashion. I want to interpret this that I introduced as being the following object. So I'm just putting intuition into some formal formulas. I don't say I know how to compute those things, but I would like to think of this as being the expectation, the average with respect to some probability distribution of a random variable Z of L that is sitting like that. And Z of L is again Z of L. I want to think. I could have used the word, well, I have to give a name to my random variable that whose cumulants give me my fugacities. And I give it the name Z of L. And it's not by accident that I use Z of L, because I want to think of this as the same as my random partition function in my problem. Because everything was controlled by something which is like one, you know, the randomness is always this type of thing. And so I want to think of this Z of L as being my random partition function defined on a system of size little l. And if I do this analogy, I can think of log of Z of L, which is a random variable, so the probability distribution of the random variable Z of L on length scale L, I can write this if I have a, I can write, and this is actually I can think of it as this identity. So here I rely on some integral representation of the log, and then if I use this equation here, I can write the following. And if I don't, because, okay, and I change variables, I go to this language here. So this is equal to square root of G of A divided by pi, integral dx on R. And then I have G of X 0 minus G of X plus L, square root of pi G of A 2L. And now I know that these functions are like Heaviside function. So I'm subtracting two Heaviside function. So I get essentially the area below a finite area. And essentially I subtract this from that. I get the area between here and here. And the position of this is given by something like here. Well, I'll write it what it is. It's equal to 2 G of A times V of A minus 1 L plus corrections of order log of L.
L plus the role of T.
Yes, I went back. I went, yeah. So I have this because I have this result, and that's what I really want to have, because you see, now I can think of having identified the typical dynamical exponent. I have related something here to some. This is a length scale, but this I would like to have thought of. I'll say it like that. What I can say is that I can say that epsilon typical. This is a definition. Is the exponential of this thing here. And with respect to the probability distribution, and this is equal, this is proportional according to this formula here, to e to the ZA times L, where ZA is equal to 1 plus G of A if G of A is smaller than 2 pi, or it's equal to 4 times G of A 2 pi minus 1 if G of A is bigger or equal to 2 pi. And this result here is what I need. I plug this result in this equation, in this exponent, and I get this. So, yeah, that's it.
We need to see how much time.
No, but that's. I mean, I could treat the case of GM larger than zero, but I think that's not important. That's technical. That's the essence of the story. So, to summarize what I have done, I have established that there exist infinitely many relevant operators. I know that they are physical. I of course, first time we met them with Zhao Gangwen and Claudio Chamon, we were very worried by the meaning of such beasts. But now I convinced myself that they have a meaning and I understand it quite well. And then the question is, how do you treat them on equal footing? We don't know how to do the full RG analysis with all of them together, but we selected a subset of them. And out of the selection, I tried to extract a evolution equation for a generating function instead of this individual coupling constant, a generating functions that will represent physically, macroscopically, what will be the random nature of the position in energy of the closest eigenvalue to the Benn center in a finite system. And this will fluctuate widely as you crank the RG scale, as the system gets bigger and bigger. This lowest energy eigenvalue is going to be more and more random. Its distribution is going to get broad. And now you have to be careful distinguishing typical value from average value. And then I did some guessing, essentially, to extract the typical value of the dynamical exponent that tells you how the typical lowest energy eigenvalue is moving as you change the system size. And I get this formula, and this went through this beautiful equation. And well, you can ask me about how robust is this beautiful equation to changing the RG scheme. Well, I didn't try another RG scheme, but apparently what mathematicians tell us is that the potential that you need to get here, this should be very solid because this is diffusion process. And then you have this nonlinear potential, but it turns out the traveling wave solution of this equation doesn't depend on the simple form given here for this potential. You just have to have some very general property of the potential. It has to have zero at g equal to zero, at g equal to one. Some its first derivative has to be something, I forgot. And that's it. That's the only input that you need to have for the existence of this traveling wave solution. So I think you can, as long as your RG scale, if we could show, we could check doing a two-loop calculation that Raoul is trying to do, that to see if how this potential is modified and to see if this result is really universal as it should be, if this is really something which is a universal property. That's not much to say other than that. I mean, maybe I can just say in words that what happens when you put GM is that now G of A is flowing, and what happens is that the flow of G of A is it's always flow to strong coupling, so you are guaranteed to hit the value 2 pi, and then the freezing transition is guaranteed to happen. And then you can again argue that this equation is relevant, and then in this way you can use this. This two-third you can get very, very simple. You can get this two-third with a very simple scaling on that if you just combine the results of Andreas obtained for this model with GM non equal to zero, for which he gives the exact beta function of G of A. And we have an exact result there. We know it grows. And then you take this result here. So when you combine the two, you get a dynamical exponent that is scale dependent, but it is either growing like G of A or growing like square root of G of A, but the growth of G of A is controlled by the beta function given to us by Andreas. So it turns out that Z of A grows either like the log of L or like square root of L. And that's enough to distinguish one half from two-third, where the one-half is the result of Gade 20 years ago, or 10 years ago, or whatever.
Okay, I guess it's kind of getting late, but questions?
Well, a long time ago there was an apparently different, well, probably certainly different localization problem, where there's an infinite number of relevant operators, which is what Alcsula Kratzoff-Lerner worked on in the 80s. And is there any kind of
what's the hope there? Well, okay, the problem is much more serious. Because the perturbations that become relevant, they don't break symmetry. They are legal perturbations. They are scalar. They are all allowed by symmetry to be present in the nonlinear similar model. So then it becomes really, if this result holds, the one loop result that they found holds, then it's very hard to interpret what's going on directly. What can I say? I mean, I guess at this stage, I mean, one thing I can say is that he's not here anymore, but what they did was to calculate the anomalous scaling dimension. They used the anomalous scaling dimensions to extract the scaling of the cumulants of the conductance. And then there is one caveat to what they have done there. Assuming that their scaling dimensions are correct, it's not an artifact, the one loop expansion. What they find is that, of course, each cumulant is going to blow up, and they all blow up independently in their approximation. And that implies the breakdown of one-parameter scaling. What this is telling us is that if their operators are truly present in the theory, there could be one way to salvage one-parameter scaling theory, which apparently should hold according to numerical analysis. But from the point of view of the validity of the nonlinear sigma model itself as a tool to attack Anderson localization, there might be a way to salvage everything, assuming that their calculation extends to higher loops. And the point is that it could be that as here, the cumulants are not flowing independently, but they are constrained in the way they grow, and they flow always to some kind of fixed point distribution, and then we recover one parameter scaling. And they didn't, so we really did the real one loop calculations because our beta functions has nonlinear term, and we calculated the scaling dimensions, but we didn't stop there. We included the physics of the nonlinear coupling between the coupling constants. They didn't. So then you can ask, what if we include this in the calculation? And we tried in class A, and the point is we get an equation, but we don't have, it's not, Kolmogorov was didn't look at it, so we don't know if it has. But I think there could be a hope in that sense. But of course, it also hinges on the fact that perhaps this is an artifact of the epsilon expansion, and this is beyond. I mean, how do you know?
The point is that they may actually not be relevant if you actually do a calculation beyond one loop order. Actually, do the actual calculation correctly, resum, and we have cases where this in fact happens. So I have an example where one loop order, it looks just like that, but if you actually, you know on general grounds, because something is bounded, some variable is bounded, that this can never go the wrong way, so they actually never become relevant in that case that I'm referring to, which is not the case we have been discussing. So it's actually open whether which happens, right, when they all become relevant or they all secretly all become behave nicely. Okay, so let's thank Christopher.